Morning, everybody. We're going to introduce the highlight of this webinar, which will be Jerry Drennan from Kennepipe, who's the executive vice president there, and the benefits advisor that he worked with, David Johnson, who's a Health Rosetta advisor. But since we have a large number of new registrants, it's really quite amazing how many people are on this, given we're in Q4 and a busy time of year. What I'm gonna do is go through a brief introduction to provide some context, and the questions and the conversation will kind of guide or sort of lead the conversation through in a similar format. So to begin with, and we're gonna have a link for the download to my most recent book, which is called Relocalizing Health. And really what Health Rosetta is about is empowering community-owned health plans. And we think of communities very broadly. It could be an employer like Kennepipe, could be a union, could be place-based. And you know, really employers are sort of fractals of a larger whole. So we'll talk more about that in future sessions, but just a little context there. One of the things I have on the back of the book, which you can see here, well, with the virtual background, it's a little hard. But basically, it's a five-step process. A lot of times people are really concerned about, even if they're not happy with the value proposition they've been getting with status quo plans, naturally, if you're trying to protect the status quo, you want to make that change seem very scary. And we just try to make it clear, like, you need to be thoughtful, for sure. But as we lay out here briefly, there's five steps. Four of the five steps are either invisible to the member or only a clear value add positive. So I can just step through that. Each one of these five steps, they spell out local in this acrostic, because you know what's more local than an interaction between a doctor and a patient? Yeah, sometimes we lose sight of that. You know, like one of the pictures in that opening slide was from my hometown, and the county I live in, it's about 250,000 people. So across all ages, we probably spend $2.5 billion on healthcare. At least $1 billion of that is extracted out of our local economy for a fundamentally local service. So that doesn't seem quite right. And so that's one of the things that we're fixing. So, you know, the old model is, you know, dream big, hope for some big bang theory. Takes a long time, and then there's some payoff, hopefully. We suggest more of a step-stair approach, with the first step being learning how to be liberated from the status quo. In the book, I'll reference some times through this brief intro, some examples. We just have tons of case studies of employers of all sizes and all corners of the country, small and large, public and private. And so it's really, the first step is just frankly a mindset shift. And we have employers regularly spending 20, even up to 55% less per capita with superior benefits. And this hasn't been happening for like a year. It's been happening up to 25 years. So it's just not what most people know. And so we're gonna, you know, give an example today of one employer and how they do that. So that's kind of the first step, just that mindset shift. You get a little benefit there. But then the next step is really about the infrastructure. This is the underpinnings of a plan. It's how you work with your benefits advisor. It's what we outline in the book and on our site, a plan sponsor bill of rights, an advisor code of conduct, an advisor compensation disclosure form. If you're new to the industry, which I was several years ago, these things look like motherhood and apple pie, but they're not the way the industry operates. In a lot of ways, they're a polar opposite. So these are things that, yes, there's some savings here, but it really is kind of the master key that unlocks other doors to savings. And so you need to get this piece right. And that's why the tip of the spear for us is our benefit advisor program. That, you know, the question I get more often than any other is, where do I start? I'm like, start with getting the right benefits advisor. It's really hard to do these things if you don't do that. So that's the first step. Again, you definitely get some savings, but it's really what it unlocks. The C in local, carve out PBM, is the first thing you start to get into kind of the care delivery side. You have examples like Caterpillar, you know, large employer, Really, the only thing they've done is applied their supply chain approach to drug procurement. Now they've been doing it for a dozen years. They haven't seen overall healthcare spending go up over a dozen years just because of what they're doing in their pharmacy. They've been really thorough. Pacific Steel, I'll mention later, and they're about 750 person company. And then state of New Jersey, they in 3 years have dropped their spending just on drugs $1.6 billion. You know, the good news, if you want to call it that, is there's lots of shenanigans with PBMs. There are some really good PBMs that work ethically and work transparently. They don't play the games of, we found up to 32 different revenue streams that PBMs have created for themselves. Most employers have no idea that there's more than one or two. So it's a lot of opportunity for savings. Within that segment, you can drop your spending 30, maybe even 50%. But overall savings, you know, meaningful. So that's kind of the next step in the step stair. And then the next step is, and by the way, people do these in different orders sometimes, and different challenges exist in different locales. And so adding value-based primary care, actually some of our most compelling case studies, you know, the Gasparilla Inn, Rosen Hotels, Bennett School Districts, these all are spending 50% less with great primary care. And by the way, there's no functioning healthcare system, well-functioning healthcare system in the world not built on proper primary care. So like the underpinning of the plan, there's some savings here because you can avoid unnecessary ER visits, avoid unnecessary and inappropriate surgeries, things like that. But again, it's kind of what it unlocks that provides a lot of the payback. So that's, again, the next step in that process. The final step is, and we're going to be talking a fair bit about this today in this webinar, where it's leave behind value extracting PPO networks. Unfortunately, you know, they probably made sense at one time, but they're just a value extraction device now. This is where the biggest savings exist. This is actually where you need to be the most thoughtful. And so you have to be, you know, if you do it right, it's great. It's definitely the biggest payoff. And I will note, we're going to talk about reference-based pricing, which is one tactic on how to do this. But I will give you, you know, a couple examples like Pacific Steel. This is a 750 person employer. They have employees in 9 states, 44 locations. 4 years ago, they were spending over $8 million on health benefits. Last year, they closed out at under $3.5 million, while benefits improved for the member, less cost sharing and or no cost sharing in many cases. Probably 3/4 of that was because they did 5,000 direct contracts with various healthcare delivery organizations. The only way you do 5,000 direct contracts in 2 years is if they're really simple and really fair. So that's one approach. We are helping employers through what we do with Health Rosetta. We have one employer, they've got about 1,500 employees. I think they're in about 3 locations. We have access now through you know, non-PPO approaches to over 30,000 doctors. So the trade-off is it's more work up front when you do that versus RBP. You can kind of reference-based pricing, you can kind of jump in, and frankly, the work comes more after the fact. And so that's a trade-off. And we'll talk about in our conversation about how, you know, there's a risk reward, and you know, you want to be prepared for that. So it's definitely something to be thoughtful about, and we'll go into more detail. So that's the final step, you know, in the process, and definitely the biggest payoff. And so with that, I want to segue into our conversation with Jerry and David, and I think it's quite an interesting journey that they've been on. And so with that, hang on a second, I will just switch screens here a little bit. And first of all, maybe just start, if you could, Jerry, with a little bit of overview about Kenny Pipe, kind of the size of the organization, the number of eligible employees, and maybe just give a little bit of the top line of what's happened over the last 5 to 10 years. I understand you were self-insured for a while and then more recently started working with David. And just as you go through that, talk a little bit, if you did see increases, was that because you were getting a bunch better benefits for your employees? Or as most people have existed, they paid more and got less. So if you can just provide a little background on, you know, your role in the organization, the journey and all that, that would be much appreciated.
Okay, thanks. Proud to be here. I'm with Kenny Pipe and Supply. We're headquartered out of Nashville, Tennessee. It's a family-owned business, been in business 28 years, and we're in mostly Tennessee, North Alabama, and North Georgia. We've got about 10 locations and 200 employees spread across those locations. We run about 130 in the plan, employees in the plan, with about 250 members. As the company had an entrepreneurial start, the owner had been in a self-insured plan for a number of years and kind of had that mindset going way back. But the plan had it kind of been on autopilot with the typical things you do through the network and and it hadn't had a lot of increases for a number of years. And then in around 2015, 14, 15, you know, the population was aging of the company and things began to increase. So to step back a bit, over the past 10 years, our employee contributions have been increased about 10%. So given the situation in healthcare, that is not bad. But what we saw around 2015 and 16, the trends were changing, and they were changing dramatically. And we saw that we were going to be faced with passing on 50% increases to our employees or the company eating a big portion of costs if we didn't do something different. And so that's when we started looking for what were some other alternatives to do that. And so over the last 3 years, since we've done some of these things, our average cost per employee has gone down 20% on medical. And over the last 2 years with our RX, our average cost per employee has gone down 12%. So that trend that was going up, we were able to stop it and help bring it down. And at the same time, I think we actually brought more value to the employees and gave them a better benefit than what they had in the past.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, one thing that was interesting that I didn't mention, and I don't know if you run any numbers on what the impact on the kind of bottom line for the business, but we had a webinar earlier with the CFO of Pacific Steel. And, you know, it's a mature, you know, pretty low margin manufacturer and recycler. And I mentioned how much they'd seen a decrease, which was pretty extraordinary. And I said, you know, what would you have had to do to increase top line sales revenue and have the same, EBITDA or profit impact? And he's like, we would have had to increase top line sales revenue 25 to 30%. I'm like, that's pretty hard for any company, let alone a mature company. So, credit to you and your organization for taking the bull by the horns on that. So maybe talk a little bit about some of the internal dynamics when you started to see that. You know, what was there a leadership discussion? And did you say you have to, you know, work with a different benefit advisor? Had been working with David that whole time? Sort of what were some of the internal dynamics? Because anytime you make a significant change, that typically isn't taken lightly.
No, we weren't working with David at the time. The discussion internally was healthcare costs is going up. We're doing the same things year over year. And we said, well, you know, we've been in an insurance captive for other lines of coverage like workers' comp, et cetera. And so we began to question, well, why aren't we in an insurance captive for healthcare? And it had been looked at in the past, but I was new to the company. I said, well, let's take a look. And so I reached out and contacted a healthcare captive. And around the same time, I did meet David through another CFO in town, and he introduced another captive. So I was researching captives from a couple of angles, and immediately began to hear some things that I had not heard before, like reference-based pricing, et cetera. And so we were pursuing that. And one of the things that happened with our old broker, when we were looking into the captive and presented the numbers, I looked at it and said, well, this doesn't make any sense. You know, we should just stay with what we're doing. And but I reached out to the guy at the captive that I'd made a relationship with and said, well, you know, I was looking forward to this, but it doesn't look like it's going to work for us. And he's like, what are you talking about? I thought the numbers looked good. And this is not what I got back. And we shared numbers, and it came back, though, you know, the numbers had been put together very misleadingly by the broker. And so he came back, and I came to one of two conclusions, either one, you did it on purpose, or two, you weren't paying attention to what you're doing. Neither one was one that was I felt like I could live with for the future. And that's why you see David in the upper left-hand corner.
Yeah.
That's how we got here.
Yeah, no, that's unfortunate to hear about when people do that, either intentionally or not. So is the way that you work with David fundamentally different than the broker before, or is there a similar model, or how do you, what's that arrangement?
I guess the arrangement is a little bit somewhat similar, although the way the broker is paid, I never could figure out how the other one was paid, but I do know how David gets paid. So we, you know, made that clear. And the other one is David's local and he's very responsive. So if I call him, I get a call back. If I don't get him on the first time, I get a call back soon. Mason works in his office. And you know, so I'm in touch with him quite frequently. Get frequent calls back, and he's just responsive. And not saying the other person wasn't responsive, but wasn't as quick. I get the calls back that day, not two or three days later or a week later.
Yeah, and in terms of how you process your claims, you know, as a self-insured organization, you know, you're typically going to hire a third-party administrator, assuming you're not processing them yourselves. Did you have one of the big carriers? Do you still have one of the big carriers processing the claims, or do you have an independent third party doing that, or how is that structured?
Well, we did change our third party administrator, and we did not have an issue with our previous one, other than when we looked into what we were going to do and decided we were going to move toward reference-based pricing, the one that we were with wasn't going to work with that, and so we needed to move. And so then David helped us identify and pick out the TPA that would work with what we were trying to do. In terms of size, David, you may pick in terms of where they fit in the spectrum. I really don't know. I need to speak to the effectiveness and response we get, which has been good.
Yeah. How, David, any comments on sort of the approach on selecting a third party administrator?
We thought, given what we knew about Jerry and his staff and just the culture of his company, that working with a local third-party administrator that had a little bit more of a hands-on approach and could effectively administer reference-based pricing, had some experience in that space, would be a good fit. And so we went with Healthscope, and they have done a good job. But as we all know, Healthscope was purchased by United Healthcare within the last probably 18 or so months. And as you'll hear Jerry reference likely later on in this webinar, they have an intentional desire to continue to drive care to higher cost facilities in the interest of their employees. And because of that, we're now looking at other TPAs that just have much greater technology that can accommodate that wish of his. So we don't know how long that relationship may last, but they've served their purpose for the last 3 years very effectively.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think you'll probably be hearing a lot more from us about this next year, but has been a little aha for me, which is a lot of times you'll hear this concept of regulatory capture, and it's definitely present in healthcare, where an industry basically captures its regulators and legislators and all that, and advantages itself. And there's no question that's a massive issue in healthcare, because you know the healthcare industry spends more on lobbying than the oil and gas, defense, and financial industries combined. So that's a factor. What I found is every bit as big of a factor is what I call contractual capture. And so like with that previous claims administrator, there's probably a good chance that something in their agreement prevented them from doing some of the things you wanted to do. And we found that there's just all kinds of terms baked into TPA, administrative service agreements. We're going to be talking about PBM shortly, that are incredibly disadvantageous to the employer. And so that's something that as we work with advisors, with employers, we focus a lot on those issues, because you could have willing buyer and seller and have some existing contract that would prevent you from doing that. Like if you have a provider that you want to direct contract with, a lot of times you're prevented from doing that. Or, you know, there's certain hospitals as a part of a hospital chain that are low quality and high priced. And, you know, some of these contracts say, if you take one hospital, you have to have them all and you can't do anything different. So there's all kinds of gotchas in these things. So something to be aware of as kind of a backdrop. So why don't we move to, speaking of PBMs, the C in local is a carve out PBM. Talk a little bit about what you're doing there. And I recall when we had our prep call, some pretty interesting stories as far as some specialty drugs and some of the challenges there and the implications for members. So maybe if you could just start, Jerry, you can provide a little overview, and then David can provide additional color commentary as needed. Maybe start with the, you know, kind of standard drugs, you know, in terms of brand and generic, kind of what you're doing there, and then we can then segue into the specialty side.
Well, we're fairly typical with the, we try to incentivize everybody to go to the generic, and so we have the generic and preferred brand, and then your brand and specialty, and we have our tiers in terms of contributions, and we really, you know, incentivize people to go to the generics. But you know, one thing that became apparent as we began to research even more is how quickly the escalation was happening in specialty drugs, and we didn't know it in 2015 when we started it, that we were going to start seeing this in a very pronounced fashion. And one of the drugs that hit us, or things that hit us, we had an individual with a $10,000 a month drug. And it wasn't one that was going to be for a condition that stops in 3 or 4 months. It was going to be ongoing. And so, you know, that was $120,000 a year you could put in right there. One of the interesting things when we were working with the captive, when I went to their meetings, is 40% of the companies in the room, you'd have over 100 companies represented in the room, 40% of the companies in the room would call that drug out by name and say they have an issue with that drug. So you knew you were, other people were dealing with that. And so one of the things that they had, many of those companies had done and started, was change their PBM and gotten away from some of the traditional well-known names that we were with. And so there was one name that kept coming up there, and I went to David and said, hey, David, this one's getting a lot of good press, and can you check it out? And he did, and we did, and we went with them. And so we got a lot of lot more transparency and a lot better service. Then we also coupled it with a specialty carve out, because just changing PBMs on that particular drug, for example, did not lower our cost to any degree. But with the carve out, you know, we partnered with a company to identify ways to use the manufacturer's assistance programs, etc., to get the drugs at a much cheaper rate. So in that particular instance, we had that one individual able to get the drug with a zero copay for the individual, which probably say $75 a month for them, and cut our costs by 75%.
Yeah, terrific. Anything you want to add to that, David?
No, I mean, we wanted to slow walk this. We didn't change the PBM the first year because Healthscope could administer it, and we thought that that might be too much disruption on the employee population. And so when we finally did, we realized savings there. And now, even to fast forward to today, and I've got to give a shout out to another Health Rosetta advisor, Scott Haas, we see that there's very likely a better way to procure drugs even going forward. And so, you know, we're just continuing to focus on that, the TPA, and the belief that we know that we can do a better job for Jerry in reducing his costs while also at the same time enhancing the benefits for the employees. So that's where we are on the pharmacy front.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's great to hear about the conversation with Scott. I mean, that's one of the things that probably is most gratifying to me is the peer-to-peer, you know, community across advisors that span across companies. I mean, I've heard from a bunch of advisors who are in larger firms, like I have more collaboration going on between my Health Rosetta brethren than, you know, internal, because we're all kind of in this, you know, similar mindset. And Scott was actually the advisor who worked with Pacific Steel. So he's very seasoned and sophisticated. A couple things I'll call out just for folks who may not be aware. One is one of the ways that you get the benefit with the specialty carve out is there's different benefits there. Sometimes there's international procurement, but a lot of times what happens is, and I believe it was a case here, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is there are programs that are called patient assistant programs that was actually built into the law that I think was the Medicare Modernization Act that passed during the George W. Bush administration. And essentially, manufacturers have to give medications free or kind of on a sliding scale based on income. And because some of these medications are so high, a lot of, you know, certainly working class people, but middle class people will qualify for either free or deeply discounted. And so then there's organizations that help facilitate that to you know, tap into those. It's all very, you know, legal and appropriate. The other thing I would mention, and you know, Scott is a particular master at this, is the degree of transparency. There's all that transparency term sometimes gets gotten watered down in our industry, and sometimes even people are transparent, but they have a transparently high price. So even if it's transparent, it's not a great deal. But one of the things that you see with the PBMs is they're master arbitragers. They know, you know, where people are going, where there's, you know, from the manufacturer, different rebates and things like that. And when we see savings, a lot of the times the biggest savings are in the generics, believe it or not, because of the games they play and the way the contracts are written. They can change the definition of a brand or generic at will in a lot of these contracts, which advantages them. And so there's things like that, again, that if you don't have an organization that's savvy about those things and digging into that, and even frankly, if you're a pretty big organization, I mean, just last week, coincidentally, I was speaking to the former head of government affairs previously for one of the big PBMs. And he was recounting the conversation that he'd had with their general counsel, where he was in the general counsel's office. There was this 4 to 5 inch thick contract that was with a Fortune 5 company. And they were kind of yucking it up, basically, that here is this Fortune 5 company, you know, some you'd be very familiar with, that they were just, particularly the general counsel, like, oh yeah, they don't have a prayer, you know, in this, because, you know, they're trying to negotiate and they just don't know all the kind of like hidden bombs, sort of, if you will, in those plans. So again, it's an area where you have to be very diligent, but the payoff is great. And a lot of times it's invisible to the member. I mean, really the only thing that sometimes the members see is their cost sharing goes down, but a lot of times you can go to the same pharmacies and all that. So, and like I said, many cases that can be invisible to the member. And if it's not, it's usually for the positive. So why don't we segue? I know that Nashville is because it's a very hospital dominated market, and they, like a lot of hospitals, have gobbled up primary care. It's more difficult there. So I know that's not something that you've tackled just yet. So why don't we segue to the second L in local, which is leaving behind the value extracting networks, and talk a little bit about, we touched on earlier, you did, that you went to reference-based pricing. And you know, again, big rewards there, but also something you have to be very thoughtful on and be, you know, prepare the organization for. So, you know, talk about that journey. Sometimes there's some bumps in the road, some bruises. You know, this is something we want you to be very frank, you know, about lessons learned, things you might do differently. Did it work? Would you do it again? All those types of things. Talk a little bit about the impact of going a different route than the traditional networks.
I'm sure I would absolutely do it again. And I would absolutely say that it works. But you also have to be prepared for how to do it. And one of the things that we did is, because we were within the captive and other companies, again, we didn't go and blaze a trail on anything. We just had, what are you doing and what's working? And I think one of the best things we got out of it, there were a couple of companies, and there was one that was a leader in the industry, and everybody said they will do it and they're great, et cetera, but they take a hard line approach, and they reimburse at 120%, and you get a lot more noise or balance bills through them, and they fight it, but they take a hard line approach. So there was another company that did 140%, and we looked at it and said, by the time you paid the fees to the other one, the cost to Kenny Pipe was going to be about the same, and the experience to the individual was going to be better with a more lenient program. So we went with it. And one of the companies that had been in the program had started with the more restrictive, and they were switching to the more lenient. So we just bypassed that first hurdle and went straight to the what I consider the better one. And, you know, the results, our first year, we had 12 cases that went through reference-based pricing, and we had 10 employees that were affected. And we paid 18% of billed charges. So we got an 82% discount. One of the things that kind of helped solidify it is, one of our first cases was actually the owner of the company. And so he went through, and they unfortunately had a significant health issue, and it was a large claim, et cetera. So he learned what a balance bill was. He saw what happened, but he also saw what the end result was. And so he was sold right off. So that helped. But, you know, one of the key things I came away with was, yes, for those 10 people, there can be a little bit more noise, but that's 10%, less than 10% of the population of people. But they're driving all the costs. So for them to do a little bit more makes it much better for the rest of the population. Because the other 90% reference-based pricing didn't touch them. They wouldn't have known it if we hadn't told them that we were on.
Yeah, no, I think it's worth noting that, you know, we'll typically see 6 to 8% of the members in any given year will drive 80% of the cost. And so it's a very targeted approach. And even when there are balance bills, you know, there's a negotiation, and, you know, still, even if you have to go above that 140%, you know, you still come way out ahead. And we've seen that the data I've seen most recently says, like, the folks who've gone at 150% of Medicare, 98%+ of the time, there's not a peep from the providers. They're happy to take that. And in the case of Pacific Steel, which I mentioned earlier, reference-based pricing has ended up becoming kind of de facto out-of-network solution. So if it's a non-emergent thing, they reach out to the organization, say, hey, you know, we've got, you know, David Johnson's coming in. He's a patient. He needs a rotator cuff procedure. We'd like to use your facility, da-da-da. And that's sort of how that direct contract thing happens in their approach. But we've at the same time seen that with just standard old PPO networks, there's 14% balance billing. So it's not like there's no balance billing on the other side. Sometimes people forget that. So that's good. And David, from your side, you know, it's definitely something different, right? What's been the impact and what have you seen? Are there any kind of behind the scenes stuff that would be good for people to know, or things that were like, oh, that was a curveball I didn't know about, or that type of thing?
Well, I don't think it's any different with an employer that's with a BUCA network as far as the importance of communication. I do think that you have to communicate more under a reference-based pricing model, specifically to the employee. And so we did take a very hands-on approach, in my opinion, to those employees that were impacted. But then I also have to say that you have to make sure that you've got an employer partner, such as Kenny Pipe, that from his owner to Jerry and to HR is willing to hold the line. And when these patients are balance billed, you just simply say, no, we're not going to walk that line. You know, this is what you were reimbursed, and this is what it's going to be. And Jerry has been extremely steadfast to that philosophy. When hospitals come back and say, hey, how about 250%? You know, Jerry is quick to say, no, here's where we are. And it has worked almost without exception for the last, I guess we're in his third year now, where there hasn't been anything that's gone to court, nothing's really gotten messy. And we just keep, you know, managing the employees' expectations so that they know that their employer is handling this properly on their behalf, and just be patient, and we're sorry about the mail that they continue to get.
Yeah. And one of the biggest chapter in my recent book, The Relocalizing Health, is on leading change, and communication is certainly one element of that. So there's a lot of stories in there about how organizations have sort of, you know, managed through this journey. And, you know, again, just like anything in life, right? The best things usually are a fair bit of work, and there's challenges along the way, but you can work through them. And this is certainly the case. And, you know, it's, if you look at the scale of the investment in health benefits, you know, it's one of the typically two, three biggest, or second, third biggest costs for a lot of companies. So let's, you know, wrap up here and just talk a little bit about, you know, are there any, you know, stories with members that have come up that are interesting, where they've shared their experience? And, you know, I'd imagine the specialty drugs, that is a big cost hit for the employee. Any stories there? You know, again, obviously not violating HIPAA here or naming any names, but you know, you're probably a step removed from it anyway, but does any stuff kind of bubble back, or have you heard feedback through HR or anecdotally? Because sometimes those will bubble back.
Well, I mentioned the one situation where we had the $10,000 a year, you know, drug, which that person is very happy. We've had a couple of others on a smaller scale that have gone through that, and they've been very happy. You know, that is one of the areas that's a little more, employees are a little more careful about, because you know, if somebody ends up reaching out to them and they're asking the you know, personal information. So we have to make sure we're communicating with employees. Yes, this is a reputable organization. Yes, you can talk to them. And yes, you can share with them. So if there's been any resistance with the way we had, it was just a concern over privacy of sharing with that. And you do have to go through that a bit. But so far it's worked well. And, you know, in terms of the, you know, the specialty carve out, you know, we have not had any real problems on the employee end. And the one thing that we really try to do, though, is as a company, is make sure that we take care of the employees. And we have a very tight line. We've pretty much got a single point of contact internally. If you have a problem, you call that person, and then that person has a direct line into either me or the owner, and we get a decision turned around pretty quickly.
Great. And, you know, to wrap up here, what's ahead? Are there any other key initiatives that you're thinking about over the next year or two, or is it more just stay the course on what you're doing?
Well, it's not really stay the course. We're always looking for something different. You mentioned the direct primary care. We have not we've not been able to make that work for us, not because we're not interested in it. David's been trying to look into that. We are very interested in it. We just need to find something that works for us. We're also looking to bundled services. David mentioned it earlier, where when you get into certain complicated surgeries, that having an agreement, a contract in place, that if you go to these locations, this is the price, and it's an all-in price. And, you know, so we're looking at that. But, you know, it's definitely not a stay-the-course approach. I spent the last 2 days on webinars for technology for my CPE, and it was on ransomware and cybersecurity. And the one thing that's clear from there, you don't put your cybersecurity on autopilot, because everything is changing and healthcare is changing too. So you can't put it on autopilot because something new is coming down every year.
Yeah, that's funny you mention that, because that's actually one of my favorite analogies that I use, is the which you have apparently is the mindset you need to have here is like a chief information security officer, that they know that what kept their network secure a year ago isn't keeping it secure today, and what keeps it secure today won't keep it secure a year from now. And unfortunately, in many ways, the healthcare industry or the hackers that are, you know, and PBMs are sort of the master hackers, but they're not the only ones, that you have to stay constantly vigilant, because there's always new things. And the industry has banked for a long time, and it's been a good bet that employers will be asleep at the wheel. And that has been the case. And so you have to have those countermeasures. And by the way, it is one of the highest duties under law is fiduciary duty, and the risk of fiduciary duty is a significant one. And one that increasingly companies realize, because director and officer liability insurance doesn't actually protect you from the risk of fiduciary. So that's a whole other, you know, reason to do it beyond just doing right by your business and your employees. So as Ellen's put in the chat box, we're going to go into Q&A in just a moment. And so we're going to provide a little overview, just a couple slides on a program that we are just, we're kind of in a beta phase right now of rolling out, which is an employer program. Just as we launched an advisor program 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, where it helped, you know, educate advisors so they could better do their job, we have just been launching an employer program to help kind of level the playing field. It's great for career development, upskilling, peer networking, all that kind of stuff. And so the sort of things that are included in it are outlined here. We have regular roundtables. We've got one next week, and we're going to be talking about mental health and sort of some of the challenges that have existed pre-COVID, but particularly during COVID. You know, we have office hours. We've got a lot of different resources, basically the ability to get much more deeply educated. We've done a lot of these sort of webinars and case studies and summits and whatnot that we can draw on. And so it gives them those resources. And it's geared towards decision makers in the benefits process. You know, the sweet spot is the mid-market, this 50 to 5,000 employee arena. You can get benefit if you're smaller or larger, but it's really particularly geared towards them. And it's $99 per month per engaged professional. And there's no long-term commitment. So if people want to do it for 2 months and get in, get out, that's fine. We're just trying to foster more education. And so if you're interested in that, just go to healthrosetta.org/employers. And you can learn more about the program, and we'll answer any questions that you might have. So we're going to hop over into the Q&A. And so let me take a look here. The first question let's see here. I'm just going to look at a few of them. This is a question probably geared towards Jerry, which is there's a number of employees not enrolled in the plan. And does the group provide those employees with other benefits or compensation, or are they just on the spouse's plan, or what's the reason they're not on the plan for whatever reason?
A lot of those are on their spouse's plan. We do not offer an incentive to not be on our plan. We do offer, if they don't need medical, we do offer medical or dental and vision as a separate option. Everything I've been talking about today has really been the medical, pure medical plan.
Okay, great. The question is around learnings from the experience of how employees have reacted to these changes. And you know, were there any decisions that you made along the way that now with the benefit of hindsight, you would have done differently on the rollout?
You know, not really. Our process has gone fairly smooth. And one of the things that happens is in any implementation, you're going to have an issue pop up. And when you have an issue, you just got to be able to resolve it quickly. And we were with partners from whether it's HealthScope or our PBM, et cetera, when something came up, or David, we get it and we get it addressed and we try to make it right for the employees. And I think if they know you're doing that, then they will work with you. And we communicate and try to make sure that we get everybody on board. And again, we get it's two calls from the final decision maker.
Yeah, that helps. One of the things that we often do when there's something we call the plan opportunity summary, that's sort of like a high level second opinion on your plan. And so we'll work, you know, with somebody like David with you've kind of already been getting it here, but we kind of go through. And one of the things we look at is there's a bunch of different things you could do, and depending, you know, you're going to have different priorities, but there's also cultural factors in terms of the level of trust that exists between management and the workforce, and that can impact what you do or not do. And it sounds like, you know, the leadership is very, you know, mindful, you know, of the employees and want to do it right by them. So it's good to hear your experience has been positive. And I bet that's because of a lot of investment that's been done over the years to build that trust. The next question is, are you doing anything to manage a J-code drug, such as carve out likes, you know, the specialty RX that a lot of times those end up sitting within medical claims, and, you know, how do hospitals, you know, react to doing something if you have done anything around J-codes yet?
We haven't, I don't think we've run into a lot of that and had an issue with that. David, you may speak to it a bit if there's any insight you can bring to bear on it.
Future initiative in our conversations with Scott.
Yeah. Okay, great. And when there is, what's the, with the RBP vendor you're working with, what's the setup? Like when there is a balance bill, is it their job to resolve it? Is it your all's job to resolve that? What's kind of the process of dealing with that, and who's kind of on the front line and who's kind of backup, if you will?
There is an organization or this tied to our TPA that is to help work with balance bills and try to, you know, seek resolution. What we do with our employees is we tell them, if you get a balance bill, send it to us. Send it to the single point of contact we have. And if this organization calls you, work with them. Other than that, it's done. Don't pay the bill. Just send it to us and don't worry about it. And then we take it from there. And as David said earlier, basically we don't negotiate on it. We gave you a card that told you our benefit, and you accepted and you provided it. So it's now done.
Yeah.
that's pretty much our position and what we've done. And so far in 3 years, it's been successful. We've not litigated one case.
Great. Anything you want to add to that, David?
I would echo what Jerry would say, or what Jerry did say. And I would also, just to go off on a slight tangent, when we introduced RVP, his costs since we've started working with him are lower every year than they were when we took over. But we've also tried to identify through the RVP process those entities that we'll just call them our RVP friendly and higher quality of care. And in our market, and I'll just say maybe especially being more in the South, we see higher deductibles than out-of-pockets. And Jerry's deductible is even on the low side for our market, which is $1,000 and has an out-of-pocket of $3,000. But because we identified an entity that was more RBP friendly, but also high quality, Jerry implemented a copay of $500 when you go to that hospital. So, you know, you take a young family that could go have a baby and it only costs them $500, or someone that needs a knee transplant, $500, or a heart issue, $500. Those are benefits that we've not seen in our market for probably close to 10 years. And Jerry's offering that to his employees. And that's just a huge thing versus $3,000 for most of these families.
Yeah, no, I've seen that almost kind of a, I don't know what the best term is, but, you know, reverse deductible or something where if the member, you don't force the member to go to a particular place, but there's a strong incentive to go to a higher quality, higher value. And particularly if you explain that, that makes a lot of difference. I mean, one of the case studies in the book is with, a school district consortium, a bunch of school districts around Pittsburgh. And there's a well-known price gouging academic medical center in that community. And at the end of the day, they're not that high a quality on most things. There's a few things they do really well. Most things they're not particularly outstanding. And so, you know, it's a decision-making body that's half union, half management. And they just agreed, if you go here, there's no copay, no deductible, anything. You go there, you're going to pay 50%. Like, that gets people's attention. And, you know, you can do that when you have labor, you know, really, you know, on board in that dynamic, but it does show what a difference it can make. There's a question around stop loss. And has there been an impact on stop loss premiums, given that you're doing RBP and some of the other Health Rosetta approaches? Is there any benefit on that front?
Not really. I mean, our stop loss, we've had a 4 or 5% increase in stop loss premiums. But you have to keep in mind your stop loss is about 10 to 15% of your cost. The 80 to 90% of your costs are in the claims.
Yep.
And that's where we focus. So I mentioned to David, I complained to him for about 2 minutes on the reinsurance bill, but then we start talking about what are we going to do to, you know, attack the other 80%.
Initially, they got about an 8 to 10% break when they migrated from a traditional network plan to RBP. So there was that that reduction. But yeah, it's been just incremental climb since then.
Yeah. And a lot of times, like when I talk about Rose and Hotels, for example, who's been doing this longer than anybody else, that's really what makes them most unique. And I'll say they spend 55% less. Really what happened was they just didn't see costs go up while everybody else did. So it wasn't like they had, obviously if they hadn't done anything for 20 years and they went to where they are now, they would see that, or at least most of that. But a lot of times it's just while everybody else accepts that prices are going up. And that's the thing I always distinguish. So there's a huge difference between costs and price. And those two get conflated in healthcare. And if you think about, other than specialty drugs, the inputs into healthcare, which are primarily labor costs, haven't fundamentally changed. Doctors and nurses aren't, they haven't, their pay hasn't increased the rates of overall premium increases. And, you know, one of my, whenever I'm talking to a group of clinicians, a guaranteed applause line is I'll say, you know, healthcare is not expensive. You know, clinicians are only getting 27 cents of every dollar ostensibly spent on healthcare. What's expensive is profiteering and price gouging and administrative bloat and just outright fraud. And so an inappropriate treatment, which is not insignificant either. And so those are the things that if you actually strip away a bunch of the gunk that's in plans, you know, I didn't go into the example of Copper State when we had the O in local, but Copper State, you know, similar, well, actually they're about 1,000 employees. They're a manufacturer and they just really dug into the contracts and watch claims. They actually, in the first year, they didn't change network. They didn't change pharmacy. And they got $1,000 per employee per year of savings. I mean, they were really rigorous on that and really did watch all the claims. But still, that's that kind of gives you an idea of if you're really hardcore on it, you can find a lot of waste in the system. So yeah, thanks for the response around the stop loss. Let's see. So there's another question around, is this intended to replace our company PPO medical coverage with our employees, or only intended for senior decision makers? So I'll answer that in because it's more of a general question, which is, yeah, these are definitely, they're applicable to everybody. Frankly, the people who need it the most are the working and middle class in America. They haven't seen a pay raise in over 20 years because all the pay raises essentially got netted out and then some by healthcare costs going up. And so the thing that's interesting, you shared the example of the owner of the company having the experience. You know, another example that I remember hearing in as a way of framing like direct primary care, they'll say, hey, this is the executive primary care plan that's available to everybody. You know, traditionally that type of care was only available for senior management, these concierge type programs, but these are direct primary care is kind of concierge medicine for the masses. And when you actually get rid of the waste and stop squandering money, there's no reason to have differentiated benefits because you can afford it for everybody. And so that's really what's happened in other organizations is the so-called solution from the industry has been, you know, push it on the back of workers. And that's not really a solution. So we're coming up on the hour. There, if you have other questions, we're going to send a follow-up email. You can always, you know, find me. I'm on LinkedIn at Chase Dave on Twitter and LinkedIn, and you can go to Health Rosetta. So happy to take other questions, but want to be respectful of everybody's time, and especially want to thank Jerry and David for investing the time with us, sharing their experience. It's great to hear these successes. It's especially great to hear how that's helping out reducing the burden on your workforce. And so with that, we're at the top of the hour. We'll wrap up. You'll get a recording of this in your email. If you don't see it, check your junk filter, and hope you all have a great weekend and great holiday season. And we'll look forward to you on the next webinar. So thanks again, Jerry. Thanks again, David. And congrats on your progress.
Thank you all.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.